This is WBAI, New York. Our next program is The Velvet Sledgehammer.
Did you ever think that you lived in a cage? Did you ever think that you lived in a cage? Well, they're calling you a chick, and the name just seems to stick, and you still don't think you're living in a cage.
Have you heard? Have you heard? There's a migration happening, going where the thinking is free.
Only you can decide. Take yourself for a ride.
You're a free-flying woman, a high-flying woman.
Did you ever think that you were up a tree? Did you ever think that you were up a tree? Well, they're calling you a name that makes you their fair game, and you still don't think that you are up a tree.
Have you heard? Have you heard? There's a migration happening.
Welcome to the Velvet Sledgehammer, the Women's Department magazine over the air. My name is Donna Allegra, and for today's program, we have two features. First, we'll bring you an interview with Ann Rhodes and Barbara Anger of Mischief Mime, the two-woman mime troupe who will be performing this evening and tomorrow at the Women's One World Theater Festival space on 19 St. Mark's Place. And secondly, we'll bring you The Varied Voices of Black Women, a rebroadcast of a live concert recorded in November 1978 at Medusa's Revenge. When we come back, we'll give you Ann Rhodes and Barbara Anger of Mischief Mime.
Is there someone out there trying to shoot me down? And they tell you they're not trying to shoot you down. Well, they're telling you a lie. Chicks have wings, but they don't fly. And you don't have to stay down on the ground.
Have you heard?
Ann Rhodes and Barbara Anger are a two-woman theater troupe called Mischief Mime. They're from Ithaca, New York, and have been working together for the past 6 years. Mischief Mime was one of several performance groups that graced the stage during the Gay Arts Festival, which is still going on. When the house lights went off at the Network Theater where they performed, out of the darkness came Mime, a performance art where one's body movements and facial expression are prop, script, dialogue, and setting. Mischief has no quibble about using the voice, unlike other mime performers. As professional artists, they tour nationally. They perform at conventions, conferences, before audiences in places like the Rotary Club and the Lions Club, and in the public schools. They also teach mime at the State University in Ithaca and private classes at their studio. Ithaca, New York is their home base, and they made the conscious decision to do their work in a smaller city where they would not be subject to the fast lane pressures of a New York or a San Francisco, and where they'd be able to have the mental space to develop along their own internal lines without reference to what the competition's doing to get over. As Anne Rhodes put it, they were big frogs in a small pond. They were the only people doing mime in Ithaca, which had the added advantage of being a supportive community with a large alternative element. The truth that they found goes contrary to the popular notion that you've got to make it in the big city, or else you're just not making it. And at this stage of the game, they're enlarging the size of their pond to have a national reach. It all began for them with Barbara Anger's interest in mime, leading her to devise the scheme of teaching a mime class to other women. The 6-week course covered the extent of her knowledge, and when it was over, because Anne was as enthusiastic about the craft as Barbara was, they decided to work at it together. Their mime was based on ideas that they wanted to play with, rather than on a highly developed technical finesse. They then carried the performance from their studio to coffee houses, women's events, and other occasions where they received encouraging feedback. As they worked at it and saw the approving audience response, they began to take their work more seriously and began to give it the kind of daily time and commitment they would give to any kind of paycheck project. The little money that came in seemed a bonus pleasure as they supported themselves from other sources at this time. Their work grew and their technical proficiency and business sense increased, and so did the money. After 3 years of developing their work together, they reached the break-even point where they could support themselves and Anne's daughter from the mime business. I say all this to introduce the interview you're about to hear. The ground we covered is the how of getting to be and being an artist who earns her living from her artwork. It takes on some of the nuts and bolts of being on that particular road. The conversation also covers the process involved in creating, executing, and performing mime in particular, but the beginning, middle, and end points are similar to anyone's work process. How did you hook up as a duo to do mime? Had you done mime before?
Well, what happened was that I had done a little bit of mime, a minimal amount, for some art openings that I was involved with in the Feminist Art Studio in Ithaca, and it was very exciting to do it, and I got turned on to the medium and wanted to do more of it, but there wasn't anybody in Ithaca doing it, so I devised a scheme of teaching mime so I could meet other people, and especially other women. And Anne came to the first class I gave, and I gave the class, and it was a nice class, but after 8 weeks, that was about all I could teach because I didn't know anymore. And I just said, look, you look real interested in this work, and I'm interested, and we're excited by each other, so why don't we work together? And
so we just started kind of hanging out, meeting regularly at the studio and hanging out and cooking up ideas and then working them out physically with mime. We didn't have any, I had no training except those 6 or 8 weeks with Barbara, and she had very little before that. So we weren't starting from a technical place. We weren't starting from a lot of knowledge of technique. We were starting just from our own ideas. And we would have an idea about something and say, let's make a piece about this. And we'd work together for however many weeks it took and work on the piece and then take it out and perform it. And at that point, we were like going to coffee houses and restaurants where they had Sunday brunch, and we'd do a free show and pass the hat, and we'd make $7, $8, $15, $20 and think it was great. And we did that for about a year of just thinking up ideas that we wanted to work with and working them out in mime and then taking them out and trying them out. And then suddenly we realized we were getting a very good response from what we did. People really liked it. We were very excited by it, and we decided it was time to take it seriously. So we started treating it like a full-time job, as though we were getting paid for it, and we would get up in the morning and we'd go to the studio and we'd start working. even though we weren't getting paid, and we had to have other sources of income to support us during this time. And we worked like that for about 3 years, including the first year, another 2 years after the first year.
I mean, we were gradually getting more and more work where we get paid for what we were doing, and we were able to, like, increase our fees at the same rate, but it was never enough to support ourselves. And then
the word started to spread slowly at first, but people started to hear that we were working and that it was exciting. And Ithaca was a really good place to get a start because it's a very receptive community. There's a large alternative community and a large student population. And when we do a show in our studio and invite people in to see it, the response would just be overwhelming, and we'd really get a lot of encouragement for what we were doing. And there was not a whole lot of competition for it. So we, during those next 2 years, we spent just sort of training ourselves, training each other, and then finally we went out and got some technical training from other teachers outside of Ithaca. Barbara went to Maine and studied with Tony Montanaro at Celebration Mime Theater, and I went to Hollywood, California, and studied with Richmond Shepherd for 9 weeks. And, of course, she came back and taught me everything she'd learned, and I came back and taught her everything I'd learned, and we just built like that. I mean, that. So we started with us, and then when we knew what we wanted to do, then we went and got the technical training that we needed, and we could go to these men and say, this is what I need from you, and just take what we needed and not deal with all the rest if there was stuff there that we weren't into doing. And because we had a sense of our own work by that time. And then about 3 years ago, we hit the break-even point, and we started earning enough money from the mime to live off of. I mean, we still don't have enough money for me to fix my car up and drive it, but we're paying the rent, and we're supporting both Barbara and I and my daughter off of what we make.
And it wasn't even a conscious thing, like, okay, we hit this point where we're supporting ourselves. I think it was more like we just suddenly realized that we were working and we weren't having to seek other jobs to make money, and that I know I felt more and more reluctant to go get freelance work. And I just, like, suddenly stopped doing it, and I was real poor, but I just couldn't push myself anymore to do something that was not directly connected to the theater and mime work that I was doing. And I think that at that point was really the turning point where, like, I had made an unconscious decision to stick with this no matter what. But it was, I don't think we ever said it, you know, we just suddenly realized that that's the way it had been going.
And we let go of the other sources of income and just made it on what we were making from this. But there's an enormous amount of commitment between the two of us, which I think is real important. I know a lot of women who are trying to do their art, whether it's performance or visual art or whatever. And if they're working alone, it's so hard for them to, like, just keep going, you know. It's so hard for them to keep pushing themselves to sell their work or to get more performances or to take it more seriously. And when my energy would flag, Barbara would be there saying, come on, you know, we can do it, this is gonna... And when hers would go down, I would be right there for her. And we really pushed each other, and we really supported each other. And together we made this just enormous commitment of time and energy and dedication to mischief. And it's really paid off for us now. In our sixth year of working together, we're starting to develop the company so that we have a national reach, so that we can tour nationally and be well enough known to be accepted, get jobs in communities all across the country.
Do you think that the two of you are any way special? Do you think you're gifted, you know, in mime? Or do you think it's more a process of deciding this is what you wanted to do?
It's the only difference between me and some other woman who wants to be a performer is that I've been doing it for 6 years. Anybody can do the same thing. These ideas, like, each person has all of the, I mean, we just deal with our own lives, the stuff that interests us or that's important to us, and everybody has these feelings and ideas, and these are the starting points for creating art of any kind, whether it's photography or painting or sculpture or writing or whatever. You start with your own stuff, your own material, your own ideas, and then you grow with it. I think the thing that's special is that we made the dedication and we kept up with it for 6 years and we really pushed it. But again, that's not like we were born with it, you know, or like we were gifted with it somehow, or that it sets us apart. Like, I really want to work against the idea that artists are a special kind of people, and everybody else isn't an artist, and then there are these few gifted individuals who are artists. I look at it that everybody's an artist. We were in Illinois last week at the National Women's Music Festival, and I taught a workshop to about 60 women, and they kept saying, they kept being so excited that they were coming up with ideas. I was structuring it so that they could see that they were creative, and I kept telling them over and over again, you are just as good as I am in terms of your ideas and what's possible for you. And I kept trying to give the power back to them. I don't want to make myself separate or special or more powerful or a separate kind of class of individual. I want to keep giving back out the power to the women so that they can see that they can do it too. And to say that I'm gifted or special, if it implies that somebody else is not gifted or not special, then I don't want to say that. We're all gifted, we're all special. We just have to, I feel like I was lucky to meet Barbara. I mean, the two of us just are incredible complements to each other. First of all, just physically, that, you know, the shapes, that I'm long and narrow and she's more round. It's kind of the Laurel and Hardy effect, you know, just physically interesting on the stage to see that visually. And then the fact that we work so well together, I think it was just a stroke of the goddess, the sweet goddess's luck that led me to Barbara and let us work together. And I feel real lucky that I just happened upon mime, because it feels like the perfect mode of expression for me. But I think everybody will be led to their place, you know, where they need to work. And
well, I think it's also a matter of listening to what your own needs are and what your own feelings are about which mode it is. It just happened to be the right place and the right time for us to hear what we really needed and keep going with it. And I think that's the same with the work too. I mean, we're both good at tuning into what is happening to us, what is happening to women and other people in the world. And we just synthesize that and we collect it and put it into a form that people can see and laugh about and understand. In that sense, we're good, but anyone can do those things and put it any mode that they choose to put it in.
There's an interesting thing about performing that makes it different from all other kinds of art, and I think about this a lot because Barbara was a visual artist doing collages and soft sculpture and things like that before she turned to mime. And when you're a visual artist, you spend a lot of time usually in isolation by yourself creating a piece of work. And then there's something tangible that's in your hand that you set out apart from yourself. And other people look at it and have a response to it. But you may or may not get an enormous amount of feedback from the people. If your stuff, if it's books you write, they go out into people's homes and you may only hear like 1% of people's response to that book. Or if it's a painting, it hangs on the wall in a gallery, and you may or may not be there when someone backs away from the wall and says, wow, look at that. You know, you may not ever hear those comments, but when you're performing, you create your art while you're on the stage. It exists for a flash. The audience responds immediately, and you get this immediate gratification for what you've done, and then it's gone. It just disappears. And the only place that it exists is in people's memories. So it's a very special kind of art form, really different from the others. And I know that for me, the immediate gratification is really great. It really helps a lot for me to be standing up there and having people clap for me.
No, but it's a trade-off. I mean, then you no longer have something there that can be seen or touched or read or listened to for later on. And it's gone. And you can't reproduce it. The spirit, the movement, always changes some. And it depends on you being there, too. Another kind of artist, you don't have to be there after it's done. Like, it's separate from you. Even though your spirit's in it, it's separate from you. I mean, that's the way it is even for music. I mean, they make a record, and you can carry somebody's spirit around in this little vinyl flat round disc, and you've got it, but
we can't do that. So it makes it a real special art, and I think that's one of the reasons that I was drawn to it anyways.
Can you speak about just the process of working in terms of you go to the studio every day as if it were a place you had to clock into? How do you feel about that? And how do you discipline yourself, structure your work? What did you have to find out in order to do that?
The process has changed a lot over the 6 years.
I think the discipline is probably the hardest.
Yeah, that's the hardest.
The absolute hardest.
Just have to keep forcing yourself to go back to it. And I know times I'd feel like I was dragging my heels and saying, oh, I do not want to go in and work on this. But you just do, and you must, and you have to, and it's always worth it. And you know you really want to, even though you're feeling these resistances.
I think the resistance is fear in some way. I'm not clear about what fears they are all the time, but sometimes I know. And then once you get there and you do it, then that's a different thing, and for us it's changed, as you were saying.
There's an enormous amount of energy that you get from going into the studio or going to your desk or wherever it is you do your process of your art and making something. Then you get this rush of energy from having forced yourself to work and work and work and work, and then something comes, and it just fits together. You know, it just, like those words just work together, or this body shape or that idea, it just somehow crystallizes, and it's perfect, and you know it, and it just works, and you just get this rush of energy. It feels great. And that's one thing that keeps you going, is that feeling. Although the performance is exciting, the real work, the real art, takes place privately in the studio with nobody watching. That's where, well there are two kinds of creativity going on with mime. The first one is in the studio, creating the piece. And that's where most of the creativity happens. And then on the stage, there's the improvisation, because a lot of our work is improvisational. And that means the spontaneous changing. It's just different every night, different things happen. I never know what she's going to do. We have sort of basic structure, but we never know quite how it's going to be filled out. But the real heavy artistic work, creative work, happens alone with no applause and nobody watching, and it's enough for itself.
What happens with that is that there's a lot of reflection, a lot of sharing ideas and experiences. So like we get to know each other pretty intimately because we have to get all of our ideas out on the table and show where they came from so that we can actually put them into some sort of form.
We've recently been working on this piece called The Crush, about people getting crushes on each other and thinking a lot about what crushes mean and that special feeling of sort of that high, weak, gaspy breath feeling that you get when you have a crush. And the first part of the process is to sit down and just laugh hysterically about crushes that we've had, past or present, and just sit down and think about all the feelings that are involved with crushes and reflect about the meanings of it and just go over that whole experience again and again and bring up memories and bring up dreams or go to our past journals and look up, you know, what we've written in the past and talk to other people and just sort of accumulate all this material on crushes. That's the first part.
It's like a bank account or a file. It's like a file that if you were doing research on a particular topic, that's our research.
It's mostly internal. It's mostly reflective, and it's very personal research. And then from that, we start structuring a piece. We may just pick one little point to start from, like when you see her on the street, you know, and your eyes meet and you feel something. And, you know, we may just start from that point and just stand up together and start moving and start improvising on possible things. And then slowly, by just gradually putting one thing onto another and accumulating little tiny pieces, the piece grows. And our performances are made up of somewhere between 10 and 14 short pieces, anywhere from 2 minutes long to 10 minutes long. So we do skits rather than plays, although we have some full-length plays we've done. Mostly we do these little skits. So a piece like grows by just adding little bits onto it until the structure is clear. And then there's this piece called The Crush.
And the way that we add on to it, there are two ways that we approach it. One is by actually thinking about where the relationships are, where our bodies should be, and what happened. And other, the other way is just getting up there and moving with all those feelings, all that background in ourselves, and just starting to move. And then that movement somehow creates the feelings and the situations that actually happen or have happened. And so it's like we have this truth that we've been working with, and then we start modifying it and changing it so that it forms a piece that says exactly what needs to be said in the most economical way, meaning that our movement...
Nothing extra.
Right.
Just paring it down to the bare essentials. And somewhere during this process, we decide whether it's going to be a silent piece or whether it's going to have words in it, because the mime that we do often includes talking. So somewhere we tend to try to not to use words unless they feel necessary for the piece, but then we're not reluctant to put them in if it's necessary. So somewhere in that process, the sound part of it becomes clear. And we do pieces about relationships between two people, what it's like to be in a couple, breaking up, things people are afraid of, power situations, mostly very personal topics, starting from real close to the person and then working out from there. It's real unusual for there to be a mime group that is made up only of women. Most of the mime groups that are successful are men. We are both feminists, so we do material that's woman-oriented, and we do feminist material, but we really feel very strongly that we don't want to be typecast into a woman's performer or be limited to a woman's audience. The kind of work that we do is real successful for people of all ages and both sexes, and we're not interested in being limited. We want to speak to everybody. Well, we do an enormous amount of work with children, which feels very, very important to us, because after all of us have fought all of our battles and died, if we haven't reached the next generation, then our daughters are going to have to fight all the same battles all over again. And I have a daughter, and I'm a mother. She's 9 years old, and I feel really strongly about bringing the work down for the young people, bringing it to their level. So we do a lot of performances in public schools. And we also do performances for, like, the Rotary Club and the Lions Club and the United Methodist Church and the Catholic Church and the Ithaca Country Club. And we really try to stay with the people, with the real people, and get away from the star tripping and get away from the lights and the action, you know, and get right down to the real people. And I'd like to encourage other artists, and particularly other women artists, to keep on reaching out, especially to children, but also to everybody, because everybody needs to hear what we have to say.
Listen to the voices of the old women. Listen to the voices of the old women, calling out the messages of the moon and sea, telling what we need to know in order to be free. Listen to the voices of the old women.
And the two voices that you just heard were Ann Rhodes and Barbara Anger of Mischief Mime. That interview was recorded about 6 months ago, and Mischief Mime will be performing tonight and tomorrow night at the Women's One World Festival Theater Space, which is at 25 St. Mark's Place. I insist on telling people it's 19, but the real address is 25 St. Mark's Place, which is between 2nd and 3rd Avenues. Our next feature on the Velvet Sledgehammer, the Women's Department magazine over the air, will be the varied voices of black women, a rebroadcast of the tape that was recorded in 1978, and a couple of years ago, a traveling show of music, poetry and song came down the line called The Varied Voices of Black Women. Audiences from the West Coast to the East were treated to an evening of Pat Parker, Linda Tillery, Mary Watkins, and Gwen Avery, and this was at the stage of the Medusa's Revenge Theater. We now bring you a partial rebroadcast of The Varied Voices of Black Women, and this won't be an entire broadcast because we don't have enough time to do all that. And the first performer to greet you will be Pat Parker doing some of her poetry. And this recording was engineered by Marilyn Reese and Viv Sutherland. The program was produced by Don Erlegger, Adrian Gant, Judy Pasternak, and Viv Sutherland. So next we bring you a partial tape of The Varied Voices of Black Women.
You know how it is when you've been through many relationships, or few relationships, depending on your lifestyle, with several women, and then one day you meet the woman, and you know it's all over, that's it, and you're hooked. In the next 10 years, you're gonna still be there and still hooked. Yeah, it's a real nice feeling. I'm gonna get a little outrageous here right now. I hope that Barbara Cobb is somewhere. I can't see. You there? Okay. See, I have this thing about writing songs. And I have been doing this for many years. But everybody tells me that my songs are real gross and outside, right? In fact, until Mary and I did Brick Hut, there was the first person brave enough to deal with my lyrics. But, you know, I did have to tone down Brick Hut a bit. Or at least Mary toned it down. Anyway, what I'm going to do is read you a song that I wrote. I'm going to read you the chorus. I'm not hardly going to try and sing this thing, okay? Anyway, this is the chorus. My baby's a bass player, fingers me all the time. I should tell you, this is done in a blues motif, so you put that on. My baby's a bass player, fingers me all the time. And when she gets down, makes me feel so fine. That's the chorus, right? She plays her modes every day, from A to A, makes me say, Jesus, honey, your hand's so kind. Don't think I'll last till you start on your lines. Then you go back to the chorus, right? She studies chord changes day and night, practices charts until they're just right. But what really makes my temperature rise is when she gets down on me and starts to improvise. Back to the chorus, right? She plays the notes for hours at a time. The utility bill here is some kind of crime. Every time she touches me, I let out a scream. Thank you, Jesus, she don't play tambourine.
You know what? Nobody knows my sorrow. Nobody knows the trouble I see.
Can't you see we're hiding in the closet?
sister, it's important to tell your brother, hey bro, truly not saying that I need yours.
There's a woman in this town. She goes to different bars, sits in the remotest place, watches the other people, drinks till two, and goes home, alone. Some say she is lonely. Some say she's an agent. None of us speak to her. Is she our sister? There's a woman in this town. She lives with her husband. She raises her children. She says she is happy and is not a woman's liver. Some say she's misguided. Some say she's an enemy. None of us know her. Is she our sister? There is a woman in this town. She carries a lot of weight. Her flesh cripples on her frame. She comes to all the dances, dances a lot, goes home alone. Some say she's a lot of fun. Some say she's too fat. None of us have loved her. Is she our sister? There is a woman in this town. She owns her own business. She goes to work in the day. She goes home at night. She does not come to dances. Some say she's a capitalist. Some say she has no consciousness. None of us trust her. Is she our sister? There's a woman in this town. She comes to all the parties, wears the latest men's fashions, calls the women mama, and invites them to her home. Some say she's into roles. Some say she hates herself. None of us go out with her. Is she our sister? There is a woman in this town. She was locked up. She comes to many meetings. She volunteers for everything. She cries when she's upset. Some say she makes them nervous. Some say she's too pushy. None of us invite her home. Is she our sister? There is a woman in this town. She fills her veins with dope, goes from house to sleep, borrows money whenever she can, pays it back if she must. Some say she's a thief. Some say she drains her energy. None of us have trusted her. Is she our sister? Once upon a time, there was a dream of women, a dream of women coming together and turning the world around, and making it over. A dream of women, all women, being sisters. A dream of caring, a dream of protection, a dream of peace. Once upon a time, there was a dream of women. For the women who rejected the dream, there's only been reassurance. For the women who believe the dream, there's dying. Women, sisters, dying. Once upon a time, there was a dream of women. A dream of women turning the world all over, and it still lives. It lives for those who would be sisters. It lives for those who need a sister. It lives for those who once upon a time had a dream. This poem comes out of an experience. One of the instructors at San Francisco State University invited two members of the American Nazi Party to come to his classroom and speak, and there was a demonstration against that. And that's what this poem deals with, the feelings I went through behind that. Don't let the fascists speak. We want to hear what they have to say. Keep them out of the classroom. Everybody is entitled to freedom of speech. I am a child of America, a stepchild, raised in the back room, yet taught how to act in her front room. My mind jumps, the voices of students screaming insults, threats. Let the Nazis speak, let the Nazis speak. Everyone is entitled to speak. I sit, a greasy-legged black child, in a black school in the black part of town, look to a black teacher. The Bill of Rights guarantees us all the right. My mind remembers chants, Article 1, and my innards churned. They remember the black teacher in the black school in the black part of the very white town who stopped us when we attacked the puppet principal, the whiteboard of miseducation, cast off books illustrated with cartoons and words of wisdom written by white children in the other part of town, missing pages, caricatures of hanging niggers. The Bill of Rights was written to protect us. My mind remembers and my innards churn, conjure images, police break up illegal demonstrations, illegal assemblies. Conjure image of a Black Panther. If Tricky Dick tries to stop us, we'll stop him. Conjure image of that same black man going to jail for threatening the life of the president. Every citizen is entitled to freedom of speech. My mind remembers and my innards churn. Conjure images of Jews in camps, of homosexuals in camps, of socialists in camps. Let the Nazis speak. Let the Nazis speak. Faces in a college classroom. You're being fascist too. We want to hear what they have to say. Faces in a college classroom. Young white faces. Speak, let them speak. Speak, let them speak. Blacks, Jews, some whites, seize the bullhorn. We don't want to hear your socialist rhetoric. Socialist rhetoric. Survival rhetoric. The Supreme Court says it is illegal to scream fire in a crowded theater. To scream fire in a crowded theater causes people to panic, to run, to hurt each other. My mind remembers, and now I know what my innards say. Illegal to cause people to panic, to run, to hurt. There is no contradiction. What the Nazis say will cause people to hurt me.